I mentioned on Monday, and let me just repeat, if Dante is the great Catholic spiritual writer, Shakespeare is the great Catholic secular writer. When Eliot said that the two divide the world between them, he wasn't just making a clever statement, he was showing real insight into the way the two writers work. They cover different territory. In the same way, if you go into an art gallery and wander through and come first to the medieval paintings, the subject matter of medieval painting is religious in nature. What you will see is room after room of beautiful Madonnas and child, visions of the crucifixion, visions of the resurrection, beautiful paintings of the coronation. It's subject matter is the things of faith looked at directly. And in that way, Dante is medieval. What he does is take us through the afterlife. But when you come to the rooms of Renaissance art, you will suddenly notice city scenes, portraits. They are magnificent paintings. They still clearly reflect, in many ways, an age of faith. But the vision is shifted. And while the Renaissance was still informed with a sense of the Catholic faith, and had to be, or we would not have the great art, it is indeed true that their vision had shifted and they were now looking at the world. And Shakespeare, in that sense, is a Renaissance playwright. He is a secular playwright. He is looking at the world. But in the same way a Titian will paint a portrait and show us a human truth, you look at one of the great Titian paintings and you're seeing a truth about human nature, so Shakespeare in the plays is telling us great truths about human nature, the world in which we live. In fact, I would say there is no other writer who ever told us so many truths about the world, and if you want to know about the world, the place to turn is Shakespeare. He's a truth teller, and being a truth teller, I would say he is certainly Catholic. It's the reason why, and I get the question constantly, especially from traditional Catholics, was Shakespeare Catholic? And what they want is for me to hold up a document and say, yes, I found it! Here it is in the archives at Stratford. Here it is. It was written down. All you need. Baptism, marriage, last rites, here it is. We have dates he went to confession. Thank God the priest wrote it down. We got the documentary evidence. They want that, and I understand that, because we live in an age of science and facts. And the response I give to them is usually inadequate, and I see the disappointment on their face when I say, of course he was Catholic, look at the plays. If you want to know what was inside the man, what he thought, how he lived, what was in his soul, look at the plays, and they don't like that. So then I give them the little, and it is true, I can give them a little piece of documentary evidence, which was the letter written by the Protestant minister who was, well, two things. First, Shakespeare's father was a devout Catholic. Devout Catholic. So on one end I can give them that, and on the other end I can give them the fact that there was a Protestant minister living in Stratford at the time of Shakespeare's death who wrote a letter to a friend and said in disgust, Master Shakespeare died a papist. So, you know, I can give them a little bit of documentary evidence on each side. But for me, it's the plays. The plays are Catholic. There's no getting around it. Although, this troubles many traditional Catholics as well, because when I say the plays are Catholic, what they are expecting is piety. And again, what they want is the medieval drama in which we get visions, we get nice Bible stories. Although Shakespeare, having learned from the medieval drama, also realized that there was more room in drama than just simple pious sentiments. The little Noah play that I staged in Italy, one of the medieval mystery plays just a couple of weeks ago, with Michael Davies as Noah. I wish you could have been there. We should have taped that. But in any case, that which tells the Noah story includes in it an incredible battle between Noah and his wife. We don't know the man who wrote it. He's simply called the Wakefield Master. He's anonymous. That's also medieval. But the fact of the matter is there's room within the drama for human drama. And even the medieval drama isn't thoroughly pious, which is what most traditional Catholics want. They want something that's nice and sweet and kind and that they can sit and be comfortable with. And in saying Shakespeare's Catholic, I would have to say part of that Catholicism is he went through the furnace of doubt. And that's what's called those are the tragedies. It was while he was writing the tragedies, he was forced. He was in the position of Saint Thomas. Okay? Doubting, not knowing, wishing to understand, but having the courage to look clearly at the world, to look into his own soul, to ask hard questions, answer them, and comes out of it with a reaffirmed faith. And it seems to me that's Catholic. That's thoroughly Catholic. And it's to me a great consolation that this extraordinary mind, this great artist, could look at the world, let the doubts come in, wrestle with all those questions, and at the end, give an affirmation, yes, and realize that God is in his heaven. The world is operating the way it should. I have responsibilities. It's extraordinarily healthy, but it ain't the sound of music with happy singing nuns. It's often dark and violent and ugly, okay? And that's what Othello is. We're going to look at the second of the great tragedies. It comes just after Hamlet. So that we talk about the big four. I mean, there's some other fine tragedies that surround it, but the big four are works of such perfection. They're usually grouped together. Hamlet, Othello, King Lear, and Macbeth. Just these extraordinary plays. Works really unparalleled. You have to go back to the Greeks to find anything equivalent. Sophocles, Aeschylus, and you can go forward and really not find much that equals these plays. But even as he was writing these plays, even as I say in the tragedies, he was walking through the furnace of doubt. At the same time, what was on his mind were Catholic questions. It's interesting because knowing I was going to come here this morning to talk about Othello, things kept popping out at me, first from Prime this morning and then from the readings at the Mass. Let me give you some examples. This all speaks to Othello. Othello contains within it the most horrifying villain ever created, aside from Macbeth, who's more horrifying because he's the hero villain. By the time we come to Macbeth, Shakespeare takes a real chance and makes the villain of the piece the hero. Puts the two together. That's an extraordinary event, and Macbeth is unequaled in that sense. But in Othello, where we have the classical protagonist-antagonist, a quick sketch of drama. I'm not going to give you a drama lecture, but I can give it to you in one sentence. What characterizes drama as apart from the other literary art forms is simply this. It is an action presented on a stage in which there is a major conflict. We watch an action presented on stage in which there is a conflict. And that conflict means we have a hero, a protagonist. And we have someone in opposition to the hero, an antagonist. And in Othello, it's perfectly clear. The hero is Othello. And the antagonist is Iago. And Iago is the incarnation of evil. Iago is the most extraordinary villain created by any literary mind. And this morning, during Prime, the reading from Psalm 51 is a depiction of Iago. And it's fascinating because critics now for centuries have been trying to figure out, why does he do what he does? Why is he so mean? Why is this guy so evil? And they've come up with a phrase to explain it. It's called motiveless malignancy. Which is it's a nice little phrase, and it does suggest something. What it suggests is we don't know. He doesn't really give us a reason. We watch him doing these things and we're not really sure why he's doing them, which makes it all the more frightening. But Psalm 51 explains it to us. And I love the little, in the little booklet here, simply Psalm 51, and then the heading under it is the hardened sinner. Why do you glory in evil, you champion of infamy? All the day you plot harm. Your tongue is like a sharpened razor, you practiced deceiver. You love evil rather than good, falsehood rather than honest speech. You love all that means ruin, you of the deceitful tongue. It's the best gloss on Iago I've ever encountered. Boom, there it is. Difference. In Dante, we go down in the Inferno to the circle of the deceivers and meet a number of deceivers. And indeed, it was there that I mentioned we see Sinon of Troy, we see Adam of Brescia, they're having that insulting match back and forth. Dante will show us a number of deceivers and take us to where they're going in the afterlife. Shakespeare, looking at this world, shows us a deceiver in action in the here and now. This is how a deceiver works in the world practicing his deceit. And as we witness it, we can come to understand its nature, and its nature is very complex and very horrifying, because the whole nature of deceit is it doesn't make itself public. A deceiver can only work his wiles if he deceives, which means we can't know he's being deceitful. Otherwise, he's a lousy deceiver. Iago is a great deceiver, but that little passage goes right to the heart of it. And then, two readings, one from the gospel that was read, the other from the alternative gospel for today. Just remember this phrase. I'm going to come back to it. It's going to be a while. Just write this down. You know the passage. It's the merchant in search of fine pearls. When he finds a single pearl of great price, he goes and sells all that he has and buys it. Okay? Just keep that gospel verse in mind. It's going to come back in the play. Whew. In an overwhelming way, in an overwhelming moment. And it's the reason why Shakespeare was writing in a Christian world where he could use a reference in one of his plays and conjure up in his audience a whole area of knowledge. We've lost that. We don't have that now, which is a shame, which is one reason we cannot appreciate these plays as fully. It's the other reason we can't write plays like this now. We don't have an audience that carries with it this kind of resonance, this richness for a playwright to draw on. The other one, and this is where I'm going to start this morning, very simple. Another gospel that may be used on the Feast of a Virgin Martyr, interestingly enough, leads us into the play in many ways. Christ, speaking to the Pharisees who are testing him, and says, "Have you not read that the Creator from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.'" Now, I'm going to emphasize that this morning, because that notion is crucial in understanding Othello. Our Lord did not say the man and the woman will become one. He did not say they would become one spirit. He did not say they would become one soul. He said they would become one flesh. We are talking about incarnate love again, which has a physical form. And that physicality is essential in understanding Othello, which is a tragedy of love. It is a love tragedy. If Hamlet is a tragedy of mind, Hamlet the thinker, Othello is a tragedy of the flesh. And specifically, love as expressed in fleshly terms, okay? I'll put that out there. I'm announcing my themes. I'm doing what I tell my students to do in the introduction to their papers. Announce your main ideas, and then, okay, so I'm doing it. Now my introduction to the other way. I've announced my main ideas. Let me move on in getting to the play. Let me do what I said you should do, okay? I will follow my own instruction, and that is, look at the title of the play. On the front, by the way, I've got to say, I love this. I realized I didn't have a little copy of Othello with me, so I ran out and bought one at the bookstore. And there's a little gold sticker on it. And on the front it says, now a major motion picture. So, you know. It's okay to buy it and read it. They made a movie of it. I recommend you don't go see the major motion picture. I'll explain why later. I'll give you reason one, I'll give you other reasons later. First reason is they cut 60% of the text. If you go see the movie, you're getting about 40% of the play, and the director in his wisdom reordered it. Shakespeare got it wrong, so he puts it in a different order. Forget it, you know, really. I'm waiting. I hope it arrives soon. There's an off chance it might arrive today. Off chance. I don't, you know. A film of a stage production of Laurence Olivier playing Othello. It's on its way. I don't know. I can't tell you when it will get here, but we will see it eventually. I believe it's Olivier's greatest performance. And it is, and this has only happened to me a couple of times, it's a performance that taught me to understand the play. A great actor can do that. A great actor can suddenly open up the play for you and show you what it means. And Olivier did that for me with Othello. Othello, it says on the front, but if you turn to the inside, you'll probably have this. The full title, as it appeared when it was first printed, was The Tragedy of Othello, The Moor of Venice. The Tragedy of Othello, The Moor of Venice. There's a contradiction in that title. Moors come from North Africa. Venice was a super civilized state. It was a small, not quite an empire, but it was a super civilized state that had sent its influence out into the world, and it was white. So what we have is a curious contradiction in the title, The Tragedy of Othello. Othello is a Moor. He is a black man. He is a black man of Venice. This is an oddity. And it's also, again, telling us something about the play that we're about to witness. So we start with the title. Contradiction in the title. Odd contradiction in the title. I'm going to give you a quick rundown of tragedy before we head into it, then we'll begin. I'm going to, this morning, largely do a close reading for you of Act 1. Because in order to get into the play and understand the play, we have to go through Act 1 very carefully. It's usually raced through, and I think the point is often missed. But, tragedy. I gave some of this when I was here talking about Macbeth. Let me just repeat it. I think it's worth knowing. Tragedy is a drama in which the principal conflict is between a hero and metaphysical powers. One might say the universe itself. As opposed to comedy, which is always a conflict between a hero and society. Comedy is social in nature. Comedy is social in nature. And even though there can be difficulties and conflicts, comedy ends happily with resolution and compromise and regeneration. Hence, the ending of comedy is marriage, where individual desire and social order can meet. I had a teacher once who said, it's very funny, comedies end with marriage, tragedies begin with marriage. It's true of both Hamlet and Othello, curiously. I guess you could say it's also true of Macbeth. But in any case, what you have with tragedy is a different kind of conflict. It obviously is social in nature in that it's set in society, but the real conflict is between a hero and something larger. And in Othello, it's very clear the battle is between the hero, Othello, and the force of evil itself. The hero is fighting evil. That being the case, we're not surprised at what happens. That is what the outcome of tragedy is. The metaphysical force wins in tragedy. The hero is broken, crushed, destroyed, but through his own doing. The tragic hero has a tragic flaw. Being human, we as Catholics understand it. The flaw is called original sin. We're all touched with it. Even the greatest of heroes is touched with it. And the vision of tragedy is that original sin, called the tragic flaw, is so great that it leads the tragic hero to make a tragic choice. At some point in tragedy, there is a choice. The tragic hero exerts his free will and makes the wrong choice and is destroyed. However, in falling, in having chosen the wrong, to move in the wrong direction, having made the wrong choice, the tragic hero falls, but in falling gains knowledge. It's the reason why tragedy is not empty and nihilistic and barren. It is in its odd way reassuring because it suggests we may be crushed, we may be destroyed, but there is still greatness in man and we can learn as we fall. We can still gain knowledge. And the tragic hero learns through his very defeat. What do we have here? Understand this. This is not the case with Greek tragedy. Greek tragedy, the hero is fated, doomed. Doesn't matter what he does. The oracle has spoken. Oedipus's parents, they all try to avoid the oracle. They can't. It's fate. Doom. There is no free will. I am speaking of Shakespearean tragedy, which is Christian in nature. There is the possibility of choice. There is free will. And even if there is a fall, that fall can be a fortunate fall. It can indeed be a felix culpa. That is, the hero is better off for having fallen. Seems curious. Seems a contradiction. But it suggests what? We can learn through suffering. That is obviously a Christian idea. And again, it's the reason why the Shakespearean tragedies are Christian in nature. The tragic heroes learn as they suffer. And sadly, the plays seem to suggest the only way they can learn is through suffering. They must suffer because without suffering, they do not have the wisdom, they make the wrong choice. They are flawed, they make the wrong choices. But once they make the wrong choice and fall and suffer, then they can come to wisdom. Well, why does it have to be like that? We want to shout. We want to sit in the audience and scream at Othello, don't listen to that guy. Don't believe him. Okay? And we feel ourselves in a superior position, but then, of course, we go out on the street, we leave and do exactly the same thing. Because we also are flawed. We are touched with original sin. We make the wrong choice. Fortunately, the consequences usually aren't this grave, though they may be. And there's one other element in tragedy that's important. And that is the fall of the tragic hero is not just a personal loss. The reason we get Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, Othello, the Moor of Venice, King Lear, and Macbeth, King of Scotland, is that when the tragic hero falls, a lot of people go with him. So that the tragedy of the individual has ramifications far beyond the personal story. It becomes a loss, not, I won't say universal, but one, it is the fall into the pond sends ripples out. And many are touched by it. And that certainly happens here. Why is that essential? It is essential because what it is suggesting is the fall of one man is not the fall of one man. We are creatures who live together in a world, and when one of us falls, we are doing damage to many others. And for that reason, Aristotle, in his great essay on tragedy in the Poetics, says, therefore, the end of tragedy should fill us with pity we have seen the collapse of another human soul, and we feel great sorrow, so it creates pity on us and fear. That fear is on two levels. One, we could do the same thing. If a great man like this can fall, what about us pipsqueaks? What chance do we have? And the second fear is this. Hey, you can be crushed because somebody else makes a bad mistake. Somebody else's bad choice can ruin you. Whoa! Does that mean, but I'm just sitting at home. I'm not going out. I'm not doing anything. I'm isolating myself. I'm being good and pure and decent and honorable, and I don't have to worry, do I? And the tragedy says, yes, you do. Yes, you certainly do. A bad decision on the part of someone around you can destroy you. Oh, well, thank you. That's a lovely idea. Pity and fear. And again, back to Aristotle, great wisdom there. And that's, at the end of Othello, we feel pity, but it should scare the life out of us. Because Othello's a greater man than most of us could ever hope of being. And look how he ends up. Whoa! Okay. Let's go into the play itself. I've got to get going or I won't get through this. The title of the play is Othello, the Moor of Venice. But only the first act of the play is set in Venice. By the end of the first act, we've left Venice and we never come back. So it is important to get a sense of what Venice is and what Venice stands for in the play and what Venice would have meant to the Renaissance audience. I was lucky enough to be in the city about 2 weeks ago, 2-3 weeks ago. And I said to some friends after I came back, I went to Venice again. And I started to say, it's my favorite city in the world. I love it above any other city in the world. And then I realized I was using the wrong word, because Venice is not a city. Venice is a work of art. It's the only place I know where the entire domain, this entire place, which is a city, isn't just a city, it's a work of art. And by that I mean, it has been designed, constructed, built. It reflects beauty, it has order, it has mystery, it haunts you, it attracts you, it has all of the characteristics that a great work of art has. The city is a work of art. Now, it would take an extraordinarily civilized group of people, I'll go one step further, it would take Catholics to build such a work of art. In the same way that it took Catholics to build the great cathedrals of Europe. Here they have done it on the level of the city, and it is breathtakingly beautiful. I got in a little boat. I'm going up the Grand Canal on a July morning, 75 degrees, the sun shining bright on these gilded palaces. I couldn't breathe. It was so beautiful. And I had a couple of friends with me who were seeing it for the first time. One of them couldn't speak. He lost the power of speech for a while. And the other friend had the power of speech, but was reduced to, and it's very nice. Guess what nationality he was? He just kept saying, oh, wow. Wow. Oh, wow. What are that? Wow. it's an appropriate action. Venice is civilization itself. Venice, we might say, is super civilized. Venice is one of the pinnacles, okay? And that's where we are, and in the first act, we're walking through those streets of Venice. We can't prove Shakespeare ever visited Venice. He had to. He had to. There are the 7 missing years. We don't know where he was. Well, a couple of those days he was in Venice, I'm sure of it. Had to be. So we're in Venice, which means we begin in a city of civilized Catholic order. That's where we're starting. And as the first conversation of the play begins, what do we get? Rodrigo and Iago, and we come into the middle of a conversation, and we're not even sure yet what they're talking about. Tush, never tell me. I take it much unkindly that thou, Iago, who hast had my purse as if the strings were thine, shouldst know of this. Now, we don't know what's going on, but we know two things. Somebody hasn't been giving out information. Rodrigo is making a simple accusation against Iago. Why didn't you tell me? You knew something and you didn't tell me. Why didn't you tell me? An announcement of the principal theme of the play, deceit. Why didn't you tell me? And number two, money. Money. Filthy lucre. Now, we have no idea where this is going, but boom, first lines, there they are. There those ideas are. Iago's blood. It's a curse. It's a short form of the phrase God's blood. They're the first words out of Iago's mouth, and it's a throwaway. It's a holy phrase that's been diminished to slang. It's blood. But you'll not hear me. If ever I did dream of such a matter, abhor me. It's only on a second reading we can get to the bottom of that. I didn't know, he says. We still don't know what he's talking about. But he's saying, I didn't know. I couldn't tell you because I didn't know. And if I did know, if I had an inkling of it, then abhor me. He knew Rodrigo should abhor him. But the first words out of Iago's mouth, a curse followed by a lie. But we as audience don't know that yet. Which means as we listen, we have no way of determining what's going on. We don't even know what they're talking about. We don't know. The audience begins the play ignorant. We don't know. We can't determine. What are they talking about? We don't know. Rodrigo, let's follow it on. Thou told me thou didst hold him in thy hate. You told me you hated him. We don't know who the him is. And by the way, we're on to a second subject now. Despise me if I... The him is Othello. You told me you hated Othello. Despise me if I do not. Yes, I do hate Othello. Now he's telling the truth. It seems awfully like the lie he just told. Who can tell when he's lying, when he's telling the truth? Nobody in the play. That's for certain. It's going to cause a lot of problems. And he goes on. I'm not going to go through this full speech. He simply says, yes, I hate him. And I hate him because he didn't promote me. He just promoted someone to be his ensign. Ancient, the old form of the word ensign. He just promoted someone, okay? I'm still the ensign. Cassio became his lieutenant. Cassio got promoted. I didn't. That's why I hate him. This is true. This is all true. He's being quite open about this. And indeed goes on and insults Cassio, insults Othello, and then says, well, there's no remedy. I'm at line 32. 'Tis the curse of service. Preferment goes by letter and affection and not by old gradation, where each second stood heir to the first. Iago's saying, look, here's what we've come to. People now get promoted not in terms of merit, but in terms of who you know. It's the old boy network. Merit, no, it's, look, this is absolutely, we still hear it today. So-and-so got ahead just because he happened to know somebody, happened to be there, he worked his way into the good graces, and therefore he got the promotion, and I didn't, and boy, I'm absolutely common. But the real argument is, and it's wonderful, notice, there used to be the old gradation. There was order. There was a time when there was order, where each second stood heir to the first, and things worked logically and orderly, but we don't have those times now, says the man who is going to destroy order in this play. But notice the curiosity. I said he's speaking truth here. What is the truth he's speaking? I expected to be promoted in an orderly succession. I did not get promoted because order no longer exists. Therefore, and this is what happens, I will destroy all order. Now, the problem with Iago is all the way through the play, he keeps coming up with reasons why he does what he does, none of which are adequate. Certainly not adequate to the carnage which with the play ends. They keep saying, I did it for this reason. No, actually, I did it for that reason. No, I did it for another reason. Which means, why did you really do it? And the reason the real reason he did it is because he's the incarnation of evil. He hates and he wants ruin. Let's follow through on the argument. This is obviously important because we still don't know what they're talking about in terms of the initial incident. Rodrigo, I would not follow him then. Why do you continue to follow him? Oh, sir, content you. I'm at line 38. Oh, sir, content you. I follow him to serve my turn upon him. I follow him for one reason alone. I'm going to get the better of him. I'm going to get back at him. I'm going to get revenge on him. He didn't promote me. I'm going to get him. The only reason I follow him is not to follow him. We cannot all be masters, nor all masters cannot be truly followed. Now, we have Shakespeare, the Catholic, writing in 1603, and the word master clearly brings up larger implications in the play. And when Iago says we cannot all be masters, nor all masters cannot be truly followed, boy, we've got resonances already. We're beginning to... Now, you say, oh, you're stretching it? Look at the last words of this speech. He ends this speech by saying, at line 62, I am not what I am. He begins the speech by saying, I'm not going to follow the master. And he ends the speech with this contradiction, the negation of the words of God himself spoken from the burning bush. Well, it's accidental on Shakespeare's part. We've got the master, we've got God, we've got, I will not follow the master, I am not what I am. We have, if you will, the negation of a divine principle. Right at the opening of the play. Now, we have to get from one to the other. Let's follow it through. We cannot all be masters, nor all masters cannot be truly followed. You shall mark many a duteous and knee-crooking knave that, doting on his own obsequious bondage, wears out his time, much like his master's ass, for naught but provender. Look, you'll see guys who follow their masters, who are good subjects, who are obedient servants, and they bow the knee, and they do what they're supposed to do, and they grow old, just like a donkey that follows his master just because he keeps being fed. And when he's old, cashiered. He's a good, loyal servant. He follows his whole life. He gets to the end of his life, and, bop, get rid of him. Donkey's too old to do work anymore. Bah, glue factory. That's the vision of obedience in service. And it's totally negative. Whip me such honest knaves. To be honest is to be a knave. If you're honest and support the existing order and do what you're supposed to do loyal and faithfully, you may not get rewarded. Therefore, you're a fool. You deserve to be whipped for being honest. Whip me such honest knaves. Others there are who trimmed in forms and visages of duty. Notice the word trimmed. It looks like they're being dutiful. It looks like they're proper in form. But it's all trimming. Who trimmed in forms and visages of duty keep their hearts attending on themselves and throwing but shows of service on their lords, do well thrive by them, and when they have lined their coats, do themselves homage. I'll look like a good servant. I'll pretend to do what I'm supposed to do, and I'll get rich by doing it. And at the end, I will honor myself. These people are everywhere. I mean, Iago's everywhere. It's a common. These fellows have some soul. These fellows have some soul. If you look out for yourself, if you get rich, if you're able to fool those you serve and turn your service to your own purpose, then you have some soul. Look at the language in this speech. It's all religious in nature. Everywhere. These fellows have some soul, and such a one do I profess myself. For, sir, it is as sure as you are Rodrigo, were I the Moor, I would not be Iago. It's a very curious speech. As much as you are yourself, if I were the man in charge, I wouldn't have a guy like me hanging around. I wouldn't trust somebody like me. I'd know better. In following him, I follow but myself. Heaven is my judge. Not I for love and duty, but seeming so for my peculiar end. Let heaven judge me that I'm not following because I love him. I'm not following him out of duty. I'm following him in order to serve my own ends. And heaven knows it. Excuse me? The things he's saying here are absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. For when my outward action doth demonstrate the native act and figure of my heart in complement extern, when you see me actually acting out what I'm feeling inside, 'tis not long after, but I will wear my heart upon my sleeve for daws to peck at. When you see me, when there is absolute connection between outward form and inner being, when the two connect, is about the same time I'll rip out my heart and put it on my sleeve and let the crows come and eat it. What he's saying is, I am disjointed. I am not integral. I am one thing on the outside, I'm something else inside, and they don't match. He says proudly, we are looking at one of the things that will define modernism, and that is fragmentation. Iago is a fragmented man and proud. I have an exterior shell that looks one way. I have an inward being that believes and acts and thinks something else, and the two do not connect. I am not integral. I am not whole. I am not what I am. And in saying that, he deliberately removes himself from God. I am who am. I am who I am. The vision of divinity, and insofar as humanity can partake of divinity, is that we are one. We are whole. We are integral. We are not fragmented. And the whole point of the incarnation and the sacraments is to heal those rifts within us, to make us whole again. O Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only say the word, and my soul shall be healed. Not Iago. What he's saying is, I'm breaking it apart more. I'm separating it more. And I'll tell you I'm doing it, and heaven knows I'm doing it. What is this? From the beginning, this is pride. This is monstrous pride. This is pride in disorder. This is pride in destruction. Well, we know who the source of all that is. We know who's being served. You cannot get past line 62 and not understand that Iago is satanic. Quite simply, satanic. And every bit as proud of it as Lucifer is. And wait a minute, what are we back to? Non serviam. I will not serve. Although Iago's clever and says, well, but I'll pretend to do so. Because I can get some real good stuff doing it. And I can really cause problems. And suddenly we're into the action of the play. Iago says, go wake up her father. Suddenly we get a sense of what's going on here. Okay? We're in the middle of the night. This is taking place in darkness. Go wake up her father. Look at what he said. I love this. He gives a series of orders. I'm at line 64. Call up her father, rouse him, make after him, poison his delight, proclaim him in the streets, incense her kinsmen, and though he in a fertile climate dwell, plague him with flies. Though that his joy be joy, yet throw such chances of vexation on it as it may lose some color. Make him really, let's go ruin his night. Let's go make him absolutely miserable. Now, I want to point out, you're all smiling. You're all smiling. I'm looking out at a room of beaming faces as I talk about creating chaos. And the reason I point this out is that Iago is successful and one of Shakespeare's most successful characters and most beloved characters because he has a streak of the comedian in him. After giving us his principles, he shows us that he's got a bit of the clown in him. He's humorous. He makes us smile. And Iago is a role that any actor loves to play because for the first 3 to 4 acts of the play, the audience loves you. He's got all the good lines. It's a famous story. There was a great old British actor named Sir Donald Wolfert, who had his own touring company. And during the war, he was an older man, and he went on tour, and they would do one great Shakespearean play after another. And most of the young men were off fighting the war, and he felt it his duty to go to the provinces and do Shakespeare. An honor to him for doing it. You know, keep the culture alive. Well, he decided, all right, next month we'll do Othello. So he found a young actor who wasn't fighting and got in and they rehearsed and Wolfert was playing Othello and the young actor was playing Iago and they opened in Manchester, rave reviews for the Iago and they didn't even mention Wolfert's Othello. So he fired the actor, brought in another one, cast him as Iago, re-rehearsed the play, they moved on to Birmingham, opening night, rave reviews for the Iago and nobody mentioned Wolfert's Othello. So he fired the young actor and brought in another young actor to play Othello, and Wolfert took the part of Iago. Because Iago gets all the good lines. Because Iago's got all the good scenes. Because Iago's got all the jokes. Because for most of the play, the audience is right there with you. Oh, look how nasty he is. Oh, look what he's doing now. Iago appeals to that in us which is fallen. And there is something about it that we... But look what he's getting away with. Look what he's doing. Wow, he's clever. Gee, I wish I could be that... Well, no. And then suddenly, because suddenly the end of the play comes and we're going, this guy's awful. And he's not funny anymore. And then we feel, okay. There is only one performance of the play ever given where the Othello takes the stage and holds it. And that's Olivier's. And we've got... The video is coming, I promise. And boy, you've got a real matchup there. You have a great actor who... Olivier trained for 1.5 years before he did the role. Because he knew what he was heading into. Because Othello is just... Olivier tells a story. Someone said to him, well, you're playing Othello. You've worked for 1.5 years just preparing. He was in his 50s. He went to the gym every day and worked out. He lowered his voice by 3 notes. I mean, he went into training to do the role. Analyzed it, decided what he had to do. He was giving this interview and they said, well, you know, why are you doing it? He said, because Othello is the most difficult of all the roles. No actor's ever pulled it off. The Iago always steals the show. And they said, well, why is that? He said, well, I can tell, he said, I don't know this for certain, I can tell you how Othello got written. He said, after the theater one night, Shakespeare and Richard Burbage, the actor who first played all of these roles, went to the bar. And they're downing ale and Burbage is saying, well, I was a pretty good Hamlet tonight, wasn't I, Will? And Will is saying, yeah, you were okay. I was pretty good. Yeah, it was an okay performance. And Burbage was saying, and I was a pretty good Henry V, wasn't I? And Will said, yeah, you were good. And I was a good Brutus, wasn't I, Will? I can do what you give me, can't I, Will? And they're downing more ale. And Will is saying, yeah, I guess you can, but I don't know. And finally Burbage downs another ale and says, I can play any role you write for me. And Shakespeare said, oh yeah, and went home and wrote Othello. It's hard. Reason being, go through the little speech, little 6 lines, you were all smiling, okay? I'll give you another one. They wake him up, okay? I'll call aloud, do with light timorous accent and dire yell as when by night and negligence the fire is spied in populous cities. Wake him up as if, what? All of Venice just started on fire. Rouse him the way you would when suddenly in the middle of the night you hear the ringing and the screaming and the city's on fire. Whew. This is deceit. The city's not on fire. Something has happened. But you don't have to inform her father of it this way. Let's scare him to death. And I'll tell you, you go to Venice and imagine fire in Venice. Horrifying. It could all be gone like that. Just last April, La Fenice, the Venetian Opera House, the most beautiful theater in the world burned like that. And they were lucky enough, they got there. What happened, of course, the canal in front of it had just been drained. The one thing you don't want for in Venice in fighting a fire is water. But of course, they were working on the canal and they had drained the canal in front of the theater. They got there, they had no water to fight it. They had to bring the water in from another canal, and by that point the theater was gone. But they managed to contain it so the rest of the city didn't burn up. Fire in Venice is no joke. What's he saying? Ha! Dire yell is when by night and negligence the fire is spied in populous cities. What ho, Brabantio, Signor Brabantio, awake, what ho, Brabantio, thieves, thieves, look to your house, your door and your bags, thieves. Brabantio comes out at the window. What is the reason of this terrible summons? What is the matter there? Signor, is all your family within? Iago says, are your doors locked? Why therefore ask you this? Zunes, sir, zunes, it means God's wounds. He's swearing again. Every time he speaks, zunes. Zunes, sir, you are robbed. For shame, put on your gown. Your heart is burst. You have lost half your soul. Even now, now, very now, an old black ram is tupping your white ewe. Oh, I won't comment. It's a bawdy joke. It's a bawdy joke. It's an animalistic joke. Your sweet little ewe has gotten out, and a big black ram is at her right now. Be aware as you read through Othello, Iago speaks constantly in animal imagery. Constantly. Arise, arise, awake the snorting citizens with the bell, or else the devil will make a grandsire of you. You better wake up, you better find him, or you're going to be a grandfather. And you'll be made a grandfather by the devil. That's Othello. We're beginning to figure out what's happened here. What? Have you lost your wits? Most Reverend Signor, do you know my voice? Not I. Who are you? My name is Rodrigo. Rodrigo's the gull, the fool, that Iago is using for his own purposes, okay? This is Brabantio the father speaking. I have charged thee not to haunt about my doors. In honest plainness, thou hast heard me say, my daughter is not for thee. Brabantio is saying, don't come here. I have told you, you do not have my permission to marry my daughter. So don't come here begging again. And now in madness, being full of supper and distempering draughts, upon malicious knavery dost thou come to start my quiet. Now you've eaten too much, gotten drunk, and in the middle of the night you're howling outside my window. What is Brabantio accusing him of? Disorder. Don't eat too much, get drunk, and come here and yell outside my window in the middle of the night here in the city of Venice saying you want to marry my daughter. I have told you no. You will not marry my daughter. I am the father. I'm in charge. I have the authority, and she will not marry you. This is overwhelmingly important. Sir, sir, sir. But thou must needs be sure my spirits and my place have in their power to make this bitter to thee. I'm a powerful man. You will be punished for this. Patience, good sir. What tellest thou me of robbing? This is Venice. My house is not a grange. I live in a city. In a city, you don't get robbed. Do you think this house is a solitary house standing out in the country, unprotected? This is Venice. Oh, okay. Boy, talk about having, right, 400 years distance, right? In a city, you don't get robbed? Whoa. But this is why I said earlier, what we're talking about here is civilization. This is back when the cities were Catholic and civilized. If you lived in a city, you didn't have to fear robbery. It wouldn't happen. He says, this isn't just a solitary... If you had a solitary house standing out in the country, then you weren't safe. And many of the granges had moats put around them, indeed for protection. Most great Brabantio, in simple and pure soul, I come to you, and then notice Iago again. Zoon, sir, God's wounds again. He swears again. You are one of those that will not serve God if the devil bid you. Whew, twisted. I can't pause on everything. Just saying, if the devil came to you and told you to serve God, you wouldn't do it because the devil told you to. The mind is the... Because we come to do you service and you think we are ruffians, you'll have your daughter covered with a Barbary horse. Right now, a Barbary horse, that is an Arabian horse, that is a Moorish horse, is covering your daughter. You'll have your daughter covered with a Barbary horse. You'll have your nephews neigh to you. You'll have coursers for cousins and genets for Germans. Yeah, you're gonna have a family. They're all gonna be horses. Because right now there's a horse going at your daughter. This, it's animalistic. It's hideous. You're all smiling again. He's funny. He's witty. Thou art a villain. Oh, wait, what profane wretch art thou? Notice, Brabantio is a civilized man. You're speaking profanely. You are a wretch. I am one, sir, that comes to tell you, your daughter and the Moor are making the beast with two backs. No commentary necessary. Awful image. Awful image. And Brabantio, being a civilized man, responds, thou art a villain. One of the few times in the play, someone nails Iago and calls him by what he is. Okay? You are a senator, says Iago. He insults him right back. And for Iago, calling a man, an honorable man, a citizen of Venice, a senator, is an equal insult. Mockery. Mockery of order, form, dignity, and propriety. You are a senator. This thou shalt answer, I know thee, Rodrigo. Okay. And then Rodrigo tells what's happened. Brabantio's daughter, Desdemona, has eloped with Othello. In the night, they have run off, and they are married. We find this out almost immediately. They are married, which means it's an honorable union in terms of the marriage. But remember where we started. Rodrigo coming to the house and being told, you will not marry my daughter. I won't permit it. And Brabantio is horrified. I'm at line about 165. Oh, heaven, how got she out? Oh, treason of the blood. His own daughter has run off and done what? She is married without his permission. Unthinkable in Venice. There cannot be a marriage without the approval of the father. That is order. That is civilized order. Fathers, from hence trust not your daughters' minds by what you see them act. Is there not charms by which the property of youth and maidhood may be abused? Have you not read, Rodrigo, of such things? He drugged her. He charmed her. He used magic on her. She would not of her own free will have done this. Yes, sir, I have. Call up my brother. Oh, would you had had her, he says to Rodrigo. Oh, I made a mistake. I should have given my approval to you. I would have if I'd known this was going to happen. Some one way, some another. Do you know where we may apprehend her and the more? I think I can discover him, if you please, to get good guard and go along with me. Pray you lead on. At every house I'll call. I may command it most. Get weapons, ho! And raise some good special officers of might. On, good Rodrigo. I will deserve your pains. End of scene one. We've not yet met the hero of the play. But what have we got? We already have a city in disorder. But notice how the disorder has begun. In one house, with one father and daughter relationship. The disorder right now is domestic. It's in one house. In scene two, it's going to spill out on the streets of Venice itself, but I'm out of time. We'll take that up at 11. See you in an hour.